As is always the case, when once the kids go to Sunday school, it's like half full. So it's good. We got so many kids. All right, so we are, if you will remember, hopefully you will, we're in the middle of a kind of like a five-part short series here this summer, covering some of the basic material that we'd like for you to be familiar with when reading the Old Testament. In part one, you might recall that we noted that there are wide differences between the culture of ancient Israel and our own, and in particular, theirs was a tribal society. Everything was about the household that you belonged to, the clan that household belonged to, and the tribe that that clan belonged to. Your identity, your place in society was determined by your family lineage, your gender, and your birth order. And we talked about what a household is, several families who are related living together in community, might remember that, and how it was governed by a patriarchal system. In part two, we looked at the custom of the levirate law, noting its importance and the fact that it comes into play quite often in Old Testament narratives. Certain passages may actually seem quite bizarre or even troublesome if we are not familiar with this particular custom and the reason for it. And Nate loves this little animation here, so I'm doing it again just for him. You do love that. I think you yelled at me when I did this the last time, like that was stupid. But I thought it was a brilliant thing on my part to have created. All right. In part three, last Sunday, we surveyed the chronology of the Old Testament, filled in a timeline, pointed out the main events and people, offered some approximate dates of those time periods, and noted how the books of the Old Testament fit into all that. And all of this is information that should prove helpful when we do a couple in-depth studies, an in-depth series that are planned for next year and the following. All right, so this morning, as mentioned last week, we want to cover the concept of covenants, what they were used for, why they were popular in the ancient world, the ideological basis for them, and what motivated those who made covenants to keep them. And understanding covenants will not only help us to understand many of the narratives in the Old Testament, but of course will help us to appreciate those select times when God makes a covenant with man. And as noted last week, we have five such occurrences. Some of those covenants are more significant than others, but all of them play a significant role in redemption history, in God's grand plan to rescue mankind. So we begin with the agreement that God had with Adam and Eve in the garden, and then with Noah after the flood, followed by, of course, Abraham regarding his descendants in the land of Canaan, and then God's covenant with Moses and the Israelites at Mount Sinai, and later on with David regarding his dynasty and the promises and blessings of that dynasty, all of which lead to the new covenant that God made with the human race through Jesus Christ. So a case could actually be made that the Old Testament is organized around these five figures and God's covenantal interactions with them, and we'll talk more about those five covenants later on, probably next spring. And for today, we're mostly interested in just getting kind of a grasp of the concept itself, what covenants are and the purpose that they serve. Now, to most of us, we generally associate the word covenant with something religious, especially when we are referencing the scriptures. But the fact is, in the time of the Old Testament, covenants were a very common thing between individuals and households and clans and tribes and especially nations. And so to better appreciate a religious covenant, an agreement God makes with a man, we have to gain some grasp of secular covenants, agreements made between people, and that will be our primary interest for this morning. So in our own society here, we're not completely clueless about this. Our society speaks of covenants when it comes to certain business arrangements, agreements between landlords and tenants, between employers and employees, business partners, and so on. That word is often used in that. And there are some similarities, but the way covenants were made and honored in ancient Israel and in the ancient world is just vastly different. We could say, excuse me, that a covenant is a type of treaty or contract. It is a type of formal agreement, but what sets a covenant apart, especially in the ancient world, is that it is also regarded as a a pledge, a sacred pledge. You know, I will keep my word and this because my honor depends on it. And it tends, therefore, to be more relational and more revered. In treaties and contracts, one party might be tempted to look for loopholes to exploit the other party. Happens all the time. But a covenant goes well beyond that, much deeper. It pertains to the spirit of the agreement more than to the letter of it. And it is rooted in the trustworthiness and faithfulness of each party to keep their agreements. And so this goes way beyond that of finding a notary to witness a signature and having Blackburn and Romy on your speed dial if things go sideways. Parties swear oaths and call upon the gods to be witnesses and enforcers. May the gods deal with me ever so severely if I do not keep my word, if I break the terms of this agreement. The Hebrews, of course, would call upon Yahweh. The sacredness of covenants can be seen by the way that they were made. Again, parties involved, they don't sit down in a conference room with a team of lawyers to sign papers. Rather, there would be a ceremony, a ritual, where an animal would be cut up and sacrificed. The picture was, may this happen to me if I fail to honor my word. And the meat then would be roasted and shared in a fellowship meal, like a family dinner. In this agreement, we are brothers. The word used in the Old Testament for covenant means to cut a covenant. It's usually translated to make a covenant, but when you look at the actual word, it's to cut a covenant. And so even if the passage doesn't mention such a ritual, the very act of making a covenant implies that such a ritual took place. So a formal definition could go something like this. A covenant is an agreement enacted between two or more parties in which promises are made under oath to perform or to refrain from certain actions stipulated in advance. Sounds a little legalese. So key words here, of course, would be agreement, promises, and oath. A big, very huge word in that. So to make sure an important detail isn't overlooked, such promises can favor one party over the other, something that we need to be mindful of, and so we should not associate covenants with equity. The agreements and promises and benefits are not always equal. In fact, they often are not, and this will become more clear here in a little bit. So an example of a covenant at the individual level could be found in Genesis 24, where Abraham sends out the chief of his servants to find a wife for his son Isaac. I don't know if you remember the story. Abraham calls on him to make an oath, to swear by the Lord that he will not take a wife from the Canaanites, but will instead go and find a wife for Isaac in the land of Abraham's family. So the narrative might not mention all the elements of a full-fledged covenant taking place here, but yet an agreement is made and it is sealed by an oath. And the arrangement is much more than just a casual promise. An example of a covenant between clans can be found in Genesis 26, where Isaac and Abimelech, the two patriarchs of their clans, enter into a covenant to stop fighting with each other and to enjoy peace. And they promise not to interfere with each other's business anymore. I may remember that story. I may have read the Old Testament. I may just don't remember the stories that you read. All right. I would raise my hand on that. All right. Last night I was reading in 2 Kings, and I don't remember reading this, and I've read 2 Kings several times, but this is all new. So it all seems new to me. All right. I think that's because I'm getting close to 70. It's going to be more like that from now on. So again, these promises, they're sealed in a covenant and it becomes sacred. And as to be expected, a number of examples in the Old Testament of covenants we have between nations. One, of course, would be that of the Israelites and the Gibeonites, of which we'll be looking at later today. So hopefully you read Joshua chapters 9 and 10 as requested to kind of prepare for that. At one point, the Israelites in that story deeply regretted making this covenant. However, they kept their word and honored the agreements made, even though doing so proved to be a major problem. So before we get too far into this, we need to back up a little bit and get a feel for the ideological foundation that covenants are based on, the philosophy behind them. And this will help us to appreciate why they were so sacred and why covenants once made were just very seldom broken. The ancient Near East recognized something called fictive kinship, probably as a word you've heard before. And you may remember from a few weeks ago in Israel's patriarchal society that an individual's privileges and responsibilities and even identity were all found in his or her household, along with the clan that that household belonged to, and most important, the tribe that that clan belonged to. It all came down, again, to lineage, gender, and birth order. And the patriarch of the household exercised the highest level of authority, and he also bore the highest level of responsibility. And all of this is how the ancients ordered their world. Who you were wasn't based on your occupation or how much money you had or membership in certain clubs or all the famous people you knew on a first name basis. It was all based on your kinfolk. And so in this arrangement, there might be times when a household would want to establish a relationship of privilege and responsibility with someone who wasn't kin. And to do that, they would have to make them kin. And this was accomplished by means of a fictive kinship. Essentially, you would invite that person into a covenant agreement which created a fictitional kinship. Fictitional because you are treating someone like family who really isn't biologically family. But yet the relationship is lived out as though it really is. Okay, and we have the same thing today in something called, what do we have similar to that today? What happens? Adoption, all right, and also marriage. By claiming someone who isn't biologically related to me as my child or spouse, I am legally binding myself to care for that individual as if they were related to me. And in the Old Testament, this was accomplished by means of an oath, by a covenant. This concept of fictive kinship is what made covenant making in the ancient Near East ideologically possible between people, between households, between clans and tribes, and even between nations. By means of a covenant, nations could establish a relationship of fictive kinship with each other, thereby securing certain privileges and responsibilities necessary for international relations. And this would be somewhat similar to peace treaties of today, but with this difference. Treaties then were enacted upon this understanding that both sides would treat each other as brothers. In this, your nation and my nation are family. You know, our word is our honor, you know, in this particular agreement. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that they still wouldn't have squabbles and disputes with each other, but they would be brothers when it came to those particular agreements, whatever they might be. And again, they would typically invoke deities as witnesses, seal the agreement with an oath, and sacrifice an animal, you know, cut a covenant, and share in a fellowship meal symbolizing their brotherhood. The meat these kings and other officials would be eating is coming from an animal that was slaughtered in everyone's presence. May what happened to this animal happen to the one who breaks their word. So a very vivid picture here. So with this in mind, we should appreciate the significance of those rare times in the Bible when God cuts a covenant with a man or a family or a nation. He makes certain promises and swears an oath upon himself, binding himself by his word to do this or to do that. It really is a remarkable thing when you actually stop to think about it. You know, that's like the absolute guarantee. You can't get a guarantee more secure than that of God making a promise and that promise being sealed by him pledging an oath on himself. And so in all this, all that is going on in chapter 15 of Genesis, if you will remember that chapter, where God makes a covenant with Abraham, should make a little bit more sense to us. That chapter talks about how God told Abraham to bring him a cow, a goat, and a ram, and to cut them in half, and how a flaming torch appeared and passed between the divided animals, and so on. You know, the whole thing seems like a little bit bizarre, a little bit weird when you read it. Like, what's all this got to do? What's going on here? So we'll talk more about that next year, but this whole episode, again, can seem really strange if we are not familiar with the making of covenants in the ancient world and the rituals involved and the meanings behind those rituals. Okay, everyone following this so far? All right. Another thing we need to be aware of is that there were two different kinds of covenants or alliances. We find both in the Old Testament. Both were common in the ancient world. One are parity treaties, agreements between equals, equals in the sense of having equal agreements, equal benefits. And the other are suzerain vassal treaties, a treaty made between a greater and a lesser power. And here one party would benefit more than the other. All right, so we'll take a moment here to consider each. The parity covenant or treaty is the one we are probably the most familiar with. The promises, the benefits, the protections, the privileges, and so forth were based on equity, evenly balanced. When these took place among nations, they were usually limited to military alliance against a more powerful threat. And any enemy that attempted to infiltrate the region would be met with a all-for-one, one-for-all kind of response from the various nations of that region who had covenanted together. And these treaties might also involve freedom of passage through an ally's territory for the sake of trade and that sort of thing. Again, in these particular agreements, you know, they were brothers. And this, of course, reveals the influence of the fictive kinship. You know, if your enemy attacks you, it's like attacking us and we will attack them. You know, we can cross your borders, we can cross yours, and so on. In this, we are brothers. The suzerain vassal treaty covenant is much different. Here, one party was clearly more powerful than the other and therefore had the right to demand submission. The powerful nation could simply conquer the weaker one easily, but perhaps it wouldn't because it recognized more benefit from a voluntary agreement. And so the powerful nation would take authority over the land and the people, but would do so peacefully. No blood would be shed, no property would be damaged. The people would often be allowed to live their normal lives and perhaps even govern themselves for the most part, but they would have to pay a tribute that entered into this agreement, give a percentage of the produce to the suzerain nation, and sometimes this taxation could be quite heavy, quite oppressive, but what choice did they have? It was that or die. And they would also have to provide men for their armies and join them in military engagements and, you know, things along these lines. The suzerain owned them and owned all they had, owned their property. In exchange, the suzerain promised to protect the vassal from outside threats and enemies. The weaker nation lost many of its freedoms, certainly suffered economically, but the treaty covenant spared them of a bloody war and loss of life, and, very important, secured for them long-term protection. Now, one thing that was definitely forbidden was that of the vassal entering into a covenant with another nation. The weaker nation could not cut a covenant with any other, whether it be a stronger power, an equal power, or even a weaker one. They did not own themselves. They had no inherent right to make such agreements, such covenants. And if they did, or if they refused to pay their tribute, or if they broke any of the other terms, they could expect the wrath of the suzerain to come upon them with full force. So the suzerain vassal treaty would not be a brother-to-brother arrangement like the parity. It'd be more like a servant-lord, yet it would still have the feel of a fictive kinship. It's kind of like more like a you know, a demanding stepdad and a helpless stepchild than brother to brother, but kinship nonetheless. There might not be warm affection, but there would be revered loyalty. All right, is that helpful so far? Following me? Okay, so one passage where a better understanding would be essential of how covenants were practiced in the ancient world would be chapters 9 and 10 of Joshua. So should I take a show of hands? How many read it this week? Oh, I'm encouraged. All right, great, good. I thought this would be a moment where my grouchiness would come forth, but instead I'll continue in my spirit of being Mr. Sunshine because we had more than five people who read it. All right, now we're not going to go through it verse by verse, but I'll basically retell the story and add comments along the way, and you can turn there if you'd like. Again, Joshua chapters 9 and 10. So we'll start by noting, very important, that in the chapters right before this, Joshua has captured two major cities in Canaan, Who remember the name of those two cities? The first one is Jericho, and the second is Ai, all right? And the Israelites have just begun their campaign to conquer and take the promised land. And so the news of these two great victories, which were unexpected, spread throughout the whole land. And the inhabitants of Canaan, the rest of them, they're just mindful of how the God of, they're also mindful of how the God of Israel, Yahweh, had delivered these people from the heavy hand of Pharaoh. And this itself is a remarkable thing. And so Canaan is inhabited by a number of different nations and tribes, these small little kingdoms, petty kingdoms, if you will. And they are all just very, very afraid. And, you know, who can stand against these people? Who can stand against their God? And they have a right to be afraid. And chapter 9 opens up verses 1 and 2 by telling us that no less than six kings throughout Canaan have formed a unified alliance to fight against them. So this would be what kind of covenant? A parity covenant equals coming together to form a military alliance. They stand a better chance of defending their land if they join and fight together. And so in their standing together against Israel, they become brothers. They become family. One for all for one. We can stand against Israel. We will stand together. But there was another kingdom in Canaan that chose a different route. They, to their credit, reasoned that no army would have a chance, not even a great and powerful army of many nations joining together. And they saw only one possibility of surviving, and so they chose a different strategy. And it, too, involved a covenant. But it would not be a suzerain vassal covenant, but it would be a suzerain vassal covenant, not a parity covenant. And it would be made with who? The Israelites, all right. And they were willing to become Israel's servants, surrender to them if it meant having their lives spared. The problem, however, and it's a kind of a big problem, is how to convince the Israelites to enter into such an arrangement with them. Would they agree to this covenant, this agreement? After all, what do they have to offer them? Nothing, really. And so their only hope is to somehow convince them that their land would be of no interest to them. And this because they, the Gibeonites, are from where? Far, 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 far away. So far away that they would not be interested. So they claim. And so a number of their leaders enter Joshua's camp and tell them that they had come from a distant land, had heard about their conquest, beg them not to kill them, but to make them and their people servants instead, and to not bother trying to take their land because, again, so far away. And the Israelites, they are suspicious, but the Gibeonites kept assuring them that they weren't from Canaan, but rather from a land far, 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 far away, thousands of miles away. In fact, we came all the way from North America. That's how far away we were. So they presented themselves, if you read the story, as worn out, wearied, exhausted travelers. They pointed out that their food, fresh when they started, is now all dry and moldy. Just look at it. Wineskins are all dried out and empty, patched up and worn, you know, nothing there, it's worthless. Their blue jeans are all tattered and worn out, and this is before the day when you could buy them that way. Their sandals are falling apart, they're held together with duct tape. You know, it's all part of this ruse of making Joshua and all the others think that they came from a distant land, and it was a clever scheme. And so verse 15, very key verse in this section, "And so Joshua established peace with them and made a treaty to let them live, and the leaders of the community swore an oath to them." In the original language, they cut a covenant. The suzerain vassal arrangement is clearly understood back in verse 8, where the Gibeonites tell Joshua, "We are your servants." Now, interestingly, the author in verse 14 points out that the leaders of Israel did not consult the Lord about this decision. Yahweh had made it very clear that they were to conquer every city and kill every inhabitant. But now, by entering into a sacred treaty, a covenant, they will not be able to obey the Lord in that. And this is a problem. And this may be one of the reasons, for why we have in the New Testament, why the New Testament warns Christians about taking oaths, because doing so could place you in a position of compromise. You may not realize it at the time you make the oath, but later it could come back to bite you. So as to be expected, the Israelites learned that the Gibeonites had lied to them. Some wanted to attack them right away for their deception, but in the end, as you know, they agreed that they had to honor the oath that they made to them, and so they let them live. And in exchange, the Gibeonites agreed to serve Israel's woodcutters and water carriers, which is probably a figure of speech for grunt labor in general. But the story here is far from over. It appears that these same Gibeonites had already, some time ago, allied themselves with other kings in Canaan in a parity treaty. And these would be kings from the southern part of Canaan. When these other kings heard of Gibeon's new alliance with invading Israel, they joined together to punish Gibeon for betraying them. The Gibeonites had originally agreed to join them in fighting off any foreign army, like something like Israel, if there were to ever be such a thing, and now there is. But now they've sold out to Israel, and so they are traitors, and they must pay for betraying us, right? Everyone following that so far? So in chapter 10, then, we read about how these armies marched up against the Gibeonites, surrounded their city, began to fight against it, and Gibeon's king responds as any vassal would who is being attacked. He reaches out immediately to his suzerain lord for aid and calls on Israel to come and to their aid. And he knows that they have to because it's part of the covenant that they had all made with each other. And I'm sure Joshua is real excited to do this, but, you know, okay, he responds. And they go and take the enemy by surprise and defeat them. Some try to escape. God enters the picture here, hurls large hailstones upon them from the sky. It's a great verse to read. And that's probably a little bit demented for me to say, but I just the picture. Yeah. All right. As the story continues, we see that all these kings who fought against Gibeon ran off, hid in a cave. Joshua learns of their whereabouts, and had them killed and hung their bodies on the tree so that, why does he hang them on the tree? So that all can see, as a warning to everybody else. So news of this spread to other kings, of course, in Canaan, which provoked no small amount of fear. Israel and their God is taking the land of Canaan. Nothing can stop them, not even a large alliance of powerful kings. All right, so there are three covenants in this particular narrative. I hope you caught them, chapters 9 and 10. See if you can recall them here. It begins with six kings, mostly from the western part of Canaan: the Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, cutting a parity covenant to form a military alliance to defend their land by fighting the Israelites together. Not much more is said about that, but we find it there in the opening verses. Then we have the Gibeonites cutting a suzerain vassal covenant with the Israelites, which turned them into servants, but yet spares their lives and guarantees their protection. And then we learn that previous to this, the Gibeonites had cut a parity covenant with five kings from the south: the kings of Jerusalem, Hebron, Jarmuth, Lachish, and Eglon. So, three different covenants in this particular narrative. And there are some noteworthy observations about how all of this plays out. I've come up here with five points. Number one, the Gibeonites honor their oaths by becoming Israel's slave laborers. Two, in so doing, they break their oaths to the five kings mentioned in chapter 10. Breaking a covenant is a very rare thing, but the Gibeonites reason that Israelites are going to kill all of these five kings anyway and all their people, so better to live than die. Better to live as servants and be known as covenant breakers and deceivers than die as honorable allies. That was basically their conclusion. Number three, the five kings honored their oaths by lashing out against Gibeon, punishing them for treason. They march up against their city to destroy it. Number four, Israelites honor their oath by fighting to protect those Gibeonites. And that is how the story ends in Joshua. But it's not really the end. Yes. Many generations later, if you know your Old Testament, and I forgot about this, many generations later, under King Saul, in fact, 350 years later, The Israelites broke this covenant with the Gibeonites. How many remember that? Broke this covenant. The account of it is found in 2 Samuel. King Saul, during his reign, had tried to kill off all the Gibeonites. And then many years later, after Saul had died and now we were under King David, the land suffered an ongoing intense famine. And after 3 years of this, David asked the Lord about it, which kind of struck me sort of funny. Like, after 3 years, you're going to inquire the Lord? I mean, everybody's been hungry for 3 years. But after 3 years, he asked the Lord about it and was told that it was because Saul had broken the covenant that Joshua had made with the Gibeonites. Very interesting. 350 years later. And so David sits down with the survivors of the Gibeonites, what few there are, asking them what he can do to make things right. And they demand to have seven of Saul's sons turned over to them. And David agrees to this, and the Gibeonites hang them on a tree. So again, covenants were a pretty big deal in the Old Testament. They were also a big deal to God. He expected his people to keep them when they made them. One can read these two chapters here, Joshua 9 and 10, and still get a good picture of what's going on. But having a fuller understanding of how covenants worked back then will certainly give the reader a better grasp and appreciation of this particular narrative and other narratives. And as you read through the Old Testament books of history, we just need to be alert to these sorts of arrangements because they will prove to be quite helpful. Even if you don't see the word covenant there, you can kind of see that that's what's going on, and then the whole picture should come into focus there. So as we finish up, there's one more point here that is worth making. As mentioned before, with legal contracts today, you know, we depend on lawyers and courts to enforce agreements. But back then, as pointed out, covenants depended upon trust and faithfulness. In fact, the Hebrew word for this sort of loyalty is hesed. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. And the word is often used in the context of a covenant, hesed. And we actually utilize that word every week. We at the end of our slides on the attributes of God, taken from Psalm 136. Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. His hesed endures forever. So though most translations render the word as love, it actually doesn't have an English equivalent. Hesed is an act that fulfills an obligation. The motivation to fulfill that obligation is loyalty, honor, faithfulness to one's word, faithfulness to the oath that was made, and, yes, love. But love in the sense that covenant has made us family. It's that kind of love. And this is the idea behind the word hesed. And it is what made covenants work in the ancient world. And so each week when we see on the slide, his love endures forever, you know, you just might think of this Hebrew word hesed and the fuller meaning of God being faithful to keep his word to us. He is obligated by his own nature to honor his covenant and has entered into a fictive relationship with us. We are his adopted sons, and in this, his faithful love will never cease. It endures forever. We should all be very grateful for that. Amen? All right, Josh, I'll have you come at this time. Close.
Thank you, Wendell. You know, there can sometimes be a temptation in studies like these to write them off as uninteresting or maybe irrelevant. If you are one who feels that temptation this morning, let me just remind you of the value of these kind of studies, how they can not only prepare us or set the stage for future more in-depth studies of the Old Testament, like Pastor Wendell alluded to, but they also set a foundation of greater understanding for our study of the New Testament. You know, we can't forget that the Bible is a progressive revelation. And you readers of books out there know that you can't go and pick up a good book you've never read before and skip the first half and jump straight to the ending. Because if you do that, you'll find yourself lost, you know, wondering about the plot, wondering about characters, wondering about how you got to where you are. And so it's the same way with Scripture as we want to understand Christ's work and the writings of the New Testament. You know, without the foundation of the Old, we're missing out on understanding as a deep foundation of events and characters and laws and the sacrificial system and covenants and promises of the Old Testament that all set the stage and prepare us for the great climax of the story in Jesus Christ. So let me challenge you to pursue, if you will, listening to these sermons with greater interest and greater investment as we go forward. So thank you again, Wendell, for your work on that. Let's all stand together. We'll read from Numbers 6. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. Go in his peace and greet each other in love.